That's right. We're here. It's 4:07 in the afternoon. Must be time for Meet Me at the Diner. Yes, I'm Ann Eller, and today it is my very great pleasure to have Solicitor David Stumbo in the building. How you doing today, David?
Doing fine, Ann. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. It's been a lot going on over there. You've been busy.
We have been. The last 2 years, I've been in office a little over 2 years now, and it has absolutely flown by. We've just had a lot of issues with prosecuting crime. We have, certainly don't have a shortage of crime and criminal cases coming in the door. And then some of the new programs that we've started here, even within the last year, the Domestic Violence Task Force, Veterans Court, other things, all of that in its totality has kept me very busy.
Now, just out of curiosity, David, as you look back over those 2 years, what do you think about what's happened since you took over?
I will say this, the morale of our office is very strong. Law enforcement, I think we have really built great relationships within law enforcement. Some of those were built, have been new relationships. Some of those have been relationships that already existed that maybe we've enhanced and gotten better. But I do feel like our track record, it speaks for itself. We've had a very good record as far as trying cases and getting convictions at trial on, I think, some of the most important cases. We're trying to prioritize the ones that the community cares about the most and the ones that law enforcement is the most interested in.
And I know when you were becoming solicitor, you thought that prosecuting those cases and getting a conviction would eventually maybe lead to less crime because people would know that they either needed to take a deal or they would be going to jail, for lack of a better way to say it.
That's correct, and I would hope that on the most severe cases, which in all the cases we handle are important. I don't want to minimize any of them, but certainly the violent crimes cases are ones that we prioritize, ones where children are being abused. Have always been a high priority in my office and will continue to be. In fact, the trial we have going on in Abbeville this week is involving child sex abuse, and one of my senior assistant solicitors is trying that case. So I think the verdict's still out on that as far as whether we have less crime or not. Certainly in 2013, the year I took office, several months after that, we had a rash of murder cases here in Abbeville. That really hit this community hard, and I think everyone knows some of the ones we're talking about, the Callison homicide that where five people were murdered and the gunman turned the gun on himself. We had another domestic homicide out in the Hodges area. We had two young ladies that were murdered at the hotel right over here on Montague Avenue.
Did that case ever get solved?
It did. That defendant was, I'll say this, probably one of the most remorseful murder defendants I'd ever seen. He cried like a baby at his guilty plea. He had confessed to it. He pled guilty, and ultimately judge gave him a 35-year sentence, which for him will be probably most of the rest of his life. It wasn't a life sentence. He was given benefit, obviously, for coming forward and not putting the families of these women through the trial. But that was resolved. I handled that case myself. We actually pled back in the summertime.
Yeah. Well, the crime is what we seem to talk a lot about. And, of course, domestic violence is one of the big issues that is across every part, even on a national level, the sports level. We're now getting a lot more, I'll say, support about what to do about domestic violence. Unfortunately, South Carolina has been number one in domestic abuse, and you said last year we fell to number two.
That's correct, and that's according to, I think, the FBI numbers. I know Attorney General Wilson cited that also at his the silent witness ceremony last year, which is a yearly thing that the Attorney General's office does. So I guess we're getting marginally better, but being number two, it's still not very good. And so hopefully the efforts being made are moving us in the right direction.
Well, and there's also the law that's out there that the Senate is undertaking right now about having a gun or owning a gun if you've been convicted of domestic violence. Where do you think you fall on this, David?
I certainly think that someone who is being convicted of domestic violence most of the time probably doesn't need to own a firearm. And I think that, that where this bill is being debated right now is not so much in the meat and potatoes of the bill, which is expanding the sentencing ranges and reforming the criminal statutes. Most of the debate has been over the gun issue, and you have very strong feelings on that on both sides. Attorney General Wilson's in the same boat, and he and I have discussed this. This is actually a bill that, that Senator Martin introduced, but Attorney General Wilson's folks actually helped draft this bill, and it's Attorney General Wilson's bill. He has told me even that he's probably a little more flexible on the gun provisions, depending on what it is. I think he feels, just like I do, that the majority of those that have been convicted of domestic violence should not be in possession of firearms. And the reason for that is they've shown a propensity to commit these type of crimes, and many the next time may be someone having their life taken, like we had so many of here in 2013. And so I'm in favor of restricting gun rights for those that have been convicted of crime. Certainly I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, always have been. I'm a gun owner. I've had my concealed weapons permit for many years now. Many of my family have as well, so I'm a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I think the Second Amendment, though, protects those who are law-abiding citizens, those that have been arrested, charged, convicted of these types of crimes, have, by their own actions, taken themselves out of the law-abiding citizen category. And so the way that the law is being tiered, I certainly think criminal, domestic, high, and aggravated, and the more severe degrees of domestic violence, there's no way those folks should be able to legally own guns.
Well,
and so
that's my opinion. One of the things that you told me before we came on the air was that I didn't realize that we have a federal statute on the books, but it's not enforced because...
That's correct.
Because why?
Well, it's the lack of... I guess the federal, that question probably would be better asked of the U.S. attorney for our state or the federal law enforcement agencies. They don't proactively go out and find someone who's been convicted on a local level of a domestic violence and say, all right, give up your guns. That just doesn't happen. The law is on the books. As a state prosecutor and our sheriff here and local law enforcement guys, we can't enforce federal law. We're not set up to do that. We're not legally, we don't have the jurisdiction to arrest someone on a federal charge. And so one of the reasons why I think this was even introduced in the state bill that we've just been discussing is that very reason. I give the state of law enforcement agencies and prosecutors some additional tools to try to keep our community safe. And so that's why we've introduce that, even though those that have been convicted of even the lowest level of domestic violence are technically in violation of federal law if they own a gun.
Well, see, you learn something new every time you do this show, and, you know, I always find that very interesting. But I think we had Senator Billy O'Dell yesterday on, and I do believe that they are in the process of debating that and trying to finish it up and send it then to the House for them to take a look at it.
Correct. Yeah, I think they've done a lot of work on it in the last couple of weeks. I've been up here in court. I haven't really closely followed it, but I think that it's going to pass in some form, and the strongest parts of the bill will go through to the governor's desk, hopefully to be signed. I'm sure she will sign it.
I'm sure she will sign it, too.
Yep.
Hey, I'm Ann Eller here with Solicitor David Stumbo. We are going to hear a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back. Hey, if you got a question for David, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold, gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. I tell you what, we're talking about a lot of the issues facing our area. And, of course, Solicitor David Stumbo is an integral part of how this whole picture comes together. You know, David, I remember when you first came on board with this office, one of the things you wanted to see was a stronger victims advocate. How's that going for you?
Well, we have currently the same number of victim advocates we had before. Part of that is a funding issue. We, as a group, the 16 solicitors around the state asked for funding to be restored. And this was funding that was in a proviso for many years in the state budget. It was removed about the time that the budget crunch came in, where revenues went down there for a couple of years. And we've asked for that to be restored now that revenues are better along
the state. Well, what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know.
They've looked at it and said, you guys are doing
yeah,
fine.
That's right. Typically, you know, if you have someone that's doing a good job, even if they're doing the job, like my primary victim advocate, Mary Ann Stroop for Greenwood and Abbeville, as I was just telling you during the break, does the job probably of two or three people. And we would be a lot better off if we could alleviate some of that. But I guess what's the old saying? If you do a good job on something, you're going to ask to do probably more.
Sure.
And we're having to, you know, do more with less with our victim advocate program. My hope is that we can, by the end of my first term, get to a place where we have four victim advocates instead of two. Now, we have two, and then also one, Leah Boudreau, who's married to one of our fine police officers here in the city of Greenwood. Jason Boudreau is her husband, is a lieutenant with the police department. Leah is the victim advocate for family court, and so she deals with victims when the crime was committed by a juvenile mm-hmm. offender. But for our general sessions, Mary Ann and Casey Tucker, who we have over in Lawrence and Newberry, cover basically two people, cover four counties. That's not nearly enough. And we need to enhance that. By the end of my first term, my hope is that we can get some funding restored for the victim advocacy program and that we have four victim advocates for our circuit because we have four counties. And so I think that would be the number where we could handle what we had much better than we do now.
Sure. And, of course, what does a victim advocate do?
There are constitutional requirements on our office, just like there are for law enforcement. Victims Bill of Rights was passed and ratified actually into the Constitution a number of years back in the 90s. The Victims Bill of Rights requires prosecutors to notify victims of court dates, mm-hmm. requires us, our office, to let them be a part of the process in court. So if a case is going to a guilty plea versus a trial, they have a right to be there. If the offender is locked up in jail and there is a bond hearing that's asked or requested by the defense attorneys, the victim has the right to be there. And so with hundreds of criminal files that we process, we have to make those contacts with the victim. So that's the biggest job, is making sure that all our victims are notified and in the loop on court. The other job is kind of the personal touch. And this would be typically, if we're in a trial scenario, making sure that those victims feel like they know everything that's going on, that they're well educated on the process. Our victim advocates aren't attorneys and prosecutors, but they understand the way it works. And so they can sit with and be a liaison between myself, if I'm the trial prosecutor, and the victim, to make sure that they don't feel uncomfortable, that we get them what they need. I mean, sometimes it's as basic as getting them a bottle of water or having one of the little cushions for the seats in the courtroom can get pretty hard.
Yeah, they can.
When you're sitting there hour after hour after hour listening to court. And so sometimes it's, hey, let me go get you a cushion or a pillow to sit on. But mainly it's to make sure that they're taken care of, because victims to us, that most of them have come across the criminal justice system through no fault of their own. And the least we can do is make sure that they walk out the door and are, if they're not completely happy with the result, they know at least we cared and we took care of them. And
sure.
So that's our victim advocate's job.
Now that's a really big job. I mean, it's a big job on any job, but I would think in domestic violence, when you have so many cases where the spouse backs out of it, I would think that would become a huge job through that right there.
No question about it, Ann. I think that's a great point, that those are some of the most important cases for us to have a victim advocate there. And the reason for that is sometimes between reporting the crime and the crime's done and police come out, respond, maybe arrest the offender, there's going to be several months between that and the court date. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, we need to make sure we support that victim. And no matter what they need, if they need to be in a safe home, and there again, we have wonderful safe homes here in the circuit between Meg's house here in Greenwood and the safe homes in Lawrence and Abbeville, make sure that they're physically safe, first and foremost. That's the first thing, to make sure that they're not at risk of being harmed again. Now, certainly, there's ones that will, those that are battered, spouses or significant others that end up going back to the abuser for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's an emotional connection. Sometimes it's pure money driven. Mm-hmm. It's this person can at least support me. And so we want to make sure that we can stand in the gap for those victims. And by the time we get to court, they're still standing strong and saying, that's what they did to me. And I want to make sure that there's justice for that. And
Those are hard cases, though, aren't they?
Very, very, very hard. And you know, sometimes one of the reasons why we like to do the training sessions, we just had one Friday with some of our agencies around the circuit. We did training on child sex abuse and wove in some domestic violence training as well. We're trying to tell the officers that are going out and making these cases to document everything. Because even if you have a victim that comes to court later in domestic violence, they may say, well, it didn't happen, or refuse to testify. You want to have as much evidence as you can where we can still go forward on that. Because a lot of times we know why that victim is not coming forward, not testifying, because they're scared.
Sure.
And so we want to make sure that justice is still done on those cases. Can't do that every time. Sometimes all we have is the victim's word. And generally in
How do you use that as just the victim's word then, David?
Well, you can't. If they have to testify and they refuse to testify and that's all the evidence we have, generally what happens is we'll call the case for trial. The defense attorney, if we don't have any evidence to put forward, will make a motion for directed verdict, and it just the judge dismisses it. And that's we don't like seeing that happen. So especially when we feel strongly that it happened. Now, obviously, if it was a false claim of domestic abuse, and that happens sometimes. Sometimes we have domestic situations where someone calls in and they just make it up. And, you know, there's been times where we've been very upset about that. And obviously the person that's falsely accusing someone, they can be charged with a misdemeanor filing a false police report. And so sometimes that can help deter that behavior. But most of the time, if a victim is not testifying, it's not because the abuse didn't happen. It's because they're afraid or they're drawn back to the batterer for whatever reason. Sure. So we need to support them and make sure we see them through the court process.
What do you think about the forming of the task force and all these things that are coming to the fore, David? Do you think we can, well, better question, how long do you think it will take to change the attitude of domestic violence?
Hopefully we're changing it a little bits at a time. I don't think this is something that we're just going to wake up tomorrow and we're not going to have another domestic violence case.
Exactly.
But I do think that there's more attention being paid to this now. I even early in my prosecution career, I remember there being this attitude of, well, if the victims don't care about it and they've recanted, then just dismiss it. We don't want to waste our time with it. I think that was sometimes a little bit short-sighted because we were overlooking why the victim might not be cooperating now.
Sure.
And I think that's starting to change. I've seen, particularly in my office, but even in other prosecution offices, we have an attorney general now that understands this and cares about it. We have a governor who understands this and cares about this issue. And a lot of guys in the legislature, a lot of our senators, and I know Senator Odell is going to be very supportive as well. So Shannon Riley, I know, is very supportive of, I think, most of the provisions in this bill. Mike Pitts, represents part of Greenwood. So
sure.
Having the community leaders on board with this and paying attention to it, Sheriff Davis is very concerned about this. I remember after the Callison incident, we sat down and we said, what in the world can we do about this problem? And that was part of the genesis, really, for our Eighth Circuit Task Force, was the meeting I had with Sheriff Davis.
I knew so it really shook him
it
down
did.
To his core.
It absolutely did. Affected him deeply, and as it did, I think a lot of, particularly the guys that were out on that scene that night.
Sure.
I ultimately, even though we didn't prosecute the case, SLED did a full file on it to make sure that we weren't missing anything, and I was... I had to review that. I say I had to because it's one of the most horrific crime scenes I've ever looked at, and I looked at it via pictures, not live, but I can assure you that's not an event that I ever want to see happen again in the circuit, if we can help it. Certainly.
I think for a lot of people it was like, how can this be happening in Greenwood?
Right.
I really do. And then to follow it up with the two girls and then over there in Abbeville, it just was like, you know, what has happened to little old Greenwood?
That's right. Yeah, it's. I think it shook the community up because it happened in such a. Well, the Callison incident in and of itself would have been bad enough,
exactly.
And then it was followed up with some other ones very quickly. And so, fortunately, in 2014, we had a much better year. In fact, a coroner, Sonny Cox, and I were discussing that the other day. He works right down the hall from me over in Park Plaza, and we talked about that. How 2014 was. Yeah, of course, there were death investigations, but generally they were natural deaths or accidental deaths. They weren't homicides in 2014,
sure.
Like we had the year before. So hopefully we're making a difference. And, you know, I really feel like the approach we've taken in court is working. I really do. Violent crimes in this circuit are, by and large, I think we're starting to see that with 2014, not...
We see an awful lot of crime in the paper, though.
Right.
We do.
We do.
Hey, we'll be back here. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Solicitor David Stumbo.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. I'm Ann Eller, right back here with Solicitor David Stumbo. We've been talking about a lot of issues. We were talking about how back in the day this was like Mayberry. If you needed to go to jail, they just called you up and said, come on down and get your warrant, right?
That's
Does it still happen that way, David?
I don't think so. It's not like Otis on the Andy Griffith Show that would come in and let himself into the jail cell. Not quite. But, you know, it ebbs and flows. And I think what we were talking about earlier, it depends on what kind of crime you're talking about. It seems like, you know, we're seeing a lot more crime. And I think in some areas, like with the abuse of children, maybe we're seeing more of them in the newspaper because now they're being reported, whereas before they weren't. Part of that's education, and part of that's a change in the attitudes of law enforcement in our schools. We have child advocacy centers now like Beyond Abuse, mm-hmm. that didn't exist 30 years ago. And part of the infrastructure that's being built to address those crimes,
sure.
is one of the reasons why we're seeing it reported more, and we're charging those cases, prosecuting them. Where in many years past, maybe those were swept under the rug. And so I don't necessarily think we have more of those crimes. It's just now we're shedding some light on an area that had not had light shed on it before.
Well, it's kind of like education of children, you know,
right.
Good touching, bad touching, you know, this type of thing. But, you know, in some aspects, I think it's kind of sad, though, David. I mean, if you even look at a child, somebody else's child, and they're being cute, and you say hello, don't talk to them.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
I think
right.
that's sad.
There's kind of a paranoia there that maybe is the reaction the other way.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think from that standpoint, it's sad. It may be good, but, you know, it's just this hard line, and how dare you even look at my child. They were in the way. I'm sorry.
That's right. Yeah, I think there are aspects of that have made us maybe too overprotective as parents. And this is coming from someone who has kids, and I do this for a living.
Sure.
And so if anybody had an excuse to be paranoid, it would be me. But I'll tell you, I don't think that's the right approach. Sometimes in life, if you get to a point where you can't trust other people at all, you're going to live a pretty lonely life. And so I would encourage folks, just get to know the people that your kids are around.
Sure.
You know, get to know them. And there's nothing that's 100% foolproof unless you put your kid in a box and never let anybody see him. And obviously that's not the solution.
Well, there are those parents that feel that, that nobody should, that there are constantly the helicopter parents and the, there was an expose a few weeks ago on, I don't know, maybe it was 60 Minutes about, it was Stossel that was talking about letting your child go a little bit, have a little freedom versus those that never have any freedom. And what's the right answer? I don't think anybody knows.
I don't know if it's a black and white answer to that. It's trying to balance it.
Yeah.
You know, you do want to be vigilant as a parent and try to protect your children, but we live in a world where bad things happen. And the one thing I don't want to shield my children on, and they've never been shielded as to what I do for a living. And that's one thing that, I don't give them every last horrible detail about a lot of the cases I prosecute, but they know where I am. If I'm in trial, my oldest two kids knew that a few weeks ago when I was in Lawrence prosecuting a guy that had strangled his girlfriend to death, a 19-year-old girl strangled to death there in the city of Clinton. And my kids knew where I was. They knew I was in court. The reason they didn't see me at night and I was working late into the night preparing for the next day of court was because they knew I was prosecuting someone who had killed a girl. And I want them to know those things, that we live in a world where bad things happen, but you also need to be able to trust people. I don't want you to be scared when you go out there and deal with people. Just be vigilant.
Sure.
Know that bad things could happen and have your eyes open to that. And I think the helicopter parents sometimes do their kids a disservice because once they get out and they are on their own, they think everything's just kind of Pollyanna, everything's great.
Well, I think they think that they still have the helicopter parent there to protect them.
That's
when
right.
They don't.
And they don't. And so I want my kids to know that we live in a world where you have to be vigilant, you have to be careful. But you still live in a world where there's good people there, too, people that will love you and support you. We're involved in a very healthy church here in Greenwood. We go to Northside Baptist and love the people there. And, I want my kids to have folks they can trust, too, and be part of a community. And so I think that's the balance, making sure you teach your kids about community, being part of a community, but also being aware that there's those that have bad intentions, too.
Well, I think actually that we could use that just on the demise of the family unit. I mean, we are at a very bad place as far as families, not just in Greenwood, but around the country. The one-parent family, the lack of the things that probably you were brought up with and I was brought up with about the stability. So the world has changed a lot for our kids growing up. I sure wouldn't want
really
to be growing
has.
Up today.
It really has, Ann. And, this is something Vanessa and I talked about this, my wife Vanessa, and very blessed to have her. Definitely married up when I married my wife. But Vanessa
just
and I
recorded
yeah,
that.
That's right. Yeah, hopefully she's listening.
Okay.
But one of the things I've noticed is how many kids now are being raised by their grandparents. It is unbelievable. How many people?
How would you like to be a grandparent having to raise children?
Do it all over again.
I know.
And, and thank God for the grandparents, because but for them, these kids would be in the system.
Right.
In the family court system and social services. So thank goodness for the grandparents. But by the same token, Ann, it's sad that there's so many people in my generation and younger, I'm talking 30s down to maybe 20s now that are having younger kids that aren't taking care of their kids. And it is a sad state of affairs. I think it's one of the reasons why we see the crime rates that we do. And a lot of the problems in society come from kids oftentimes being kicked from pillar to post. And how do you fix that other than, parents girding up and saying, all right, I'm going to take responsibility for the kids I put into this world. I don't know if I can fix that in what I do in my job completely.
Sure.
I can prosecute the crime. We can try to create an environment where good is rewarded and bad is punished. We can do that. But the deeper problem of kids not having their parents raise them is a significant problem in society right now.
It is. And so I guess that's why you signed on to be a judge for the Greenwood Stars, the dancing that will be going on April 25th. You are going to be a judge. How come you're not dancing, David?
Oh, gosh. If I were dancing, it would be people would need therapy afterwards and counseling for having to see the debacle that it would be for me to be up on that stage dancing. I'm not a very good dancer, but I'm going to have fun with this because I do like watching dance. I've watched Dancing with the Stars and some of those shows, and I've always admired people that can dance really well. In fact, my brother-in-law is Jake Bartley. He's married to my sister. I don't know if you knew that. Jake is one of my favorite people in the world, in addition to being a family member now through marriage. Jake, you put Jake or his dad Hack out on a dance floor and watch them shag, it is a sight to behold. And I don't have it in my blood, I guess. I don't know. Since they're not blood relatives, I kind of wish I had a little bit of that Bartley blood. Maybe I could shag better than I do. But I'm going to have fun with that. And it's for a great cause. And what Kathy Miller, and I know you had her on the show recently, and what she's been able to do to help come alongside these guys at Beyond Abuse. They didn't really have a way to raise funds before. They had a lot of good people there that were doing the work on the ground. Mm-hmm. Kathy thinks on a higher level. She thinks like a business person. And
well, that's what she was.
And that's
in
what
all
she
her
did.
Life, right?
And that's what makes her such a great fit to lead that agency, because mm-hmm. now she can look at other ways they can get money in and try to enhance their operations there. And this is just one of the fundraisers that they do. And I'm just proud to be part of it.
So do you get instruction on how to be a judge? I mean, I'm just trying to understand this. I mean, do you get instruction on this?
Well, I haven't yet, but I'm supposed to do some research on this. In fact, Lance Sheik in my office is going to be one of the participants. And he said
he's been talking to you about
he's a little bit
vote.
That's yeah exactly. I may have to recuse myself when he dances. I may have to back off of the voting. But he says that his partner wants to do the dance at the end of Dirty Dancing, Have the Time of My Life dance, and so he's a little bit scared. He said he went online and watched the video again and is trying to analyze it. So I guess I'm gonna have to do my homework too to be a competent
judge. Yes.
Right.
All right. Well, that's coming up April 25th. That's going to be a lot of fun. They already have a website where you can buy the tickets to it. I think it's Greenwood Stars. Is that right?
I believe that's right.
Greenwood Stars.
That's correct. Yeah.
But if you go to Beyond Abuse, I'm pretty sure there'd be a link on that, Beyond Abuse, and check that one out. But we had Kathy on a couple of weeks ago now, had a great time talking to her about this event. It's going to be huge.
It will be huge. It'll be a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes, and I'm going to be on the red carpet interviewing people on the way in. I guess I'll have to get an E, WCRS E Entertainment. Hey, we'll be right back. Don't you go away.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Oh, that's right. Right back here. Hey, we had a question come on in here to Solicitor David Stumbo. David, the person wanted to know who is responsible when it comes to a restraining order, the police, the sheriff, the person themselves. How does this work?
Typically, it's in conjunction with the person seeking the restraining order and the sheriff's office. Or if it's within the city limits, you can also the city magistrate can issue a restraining order as well. We can assist with that and help put if we have a victim in a case, we can help get them to the magistrate's office, apply for it, and get the restraining order in place. Mm-hmm. It's not hard to get a restraining order. It's not a hard process to get. Now, the more difficult thing is making sure it gets enforced. And
correct.
The enforcement of that generally is going to be if we have a pending criminal charge in general sessions, we can move to have that person's bond revoked if they've been given a bond early on in the case by a judge and make bond. If they're out there, they have a no contact order with their victim. Mm-hmm. And so not only do they have a no contact order with their bond, but most of the time we have the victims get a restraining order as well. So they're in violation of both the magistrate's order and the circuit court's order for the no contact. And so what we can do is, if there's a pending criminal charge, we can move to have their bond revoked and have them locked back up if they're violating that. Mm-hmm. If we don't have a criminal charge on them, generally it's kind of up to the law enforcement agency. So the sheriff's office, if they know someone's violating a county magistrate judge's restraining order, they can have someone picked up on that.
So it really would be the person who had the restraining order against somebody would need to call.
Report it, and the sheriff's office should be obligated at that point to go enforce the judge's order and arrest the person. There again, we can't have much involvement with it as the prosecutors if there's not a pending charge. Sometimes people go get restraining orders for a variety of reasons, and there may not be a criminal charge pending against that person. And so in those cases, it would fall really exclusively back on the law enforcement officers to execute it. If we have a criminal charge, we can get involved with that. Usually it would take the law enforcement officer who goes and takes a report on that to let us know. Because my prosecutors won't know about it unless the victim or the officer tells us. And then in that case, we can have the bond revoked and hopefully.
Now, do you get a piece of paper? This is just a little fun. Do you get a piece of paper if somebody gets a restraining order? Do you get a piece of paper that says that you're not supposed to be close to me? I mean, can I just hold this up and say, no, you're not supposed to be any closer than this to me? I don't know.
The order should be served on the person that it's sought against. Does that make sense? And then there again, the law enforcement agencies serve the papers.
Okay.
And so that puts them on notice that they can't come within 50 feet or whatever the order says.
So I don't have a piece of paper that I walk around with and say, back.
Well, you can.
No, you can.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get a copy of the order and walk around with it in your pocketbook in your back pocket if you want to. But no, there is an official document that is signed by a magistrate court, which has county jurisdiction, that restrains the person from doing that. There again, the enforcement would have to come from the victim and the victim reporting it, saying, hey, they showed up at my door and knocked on the door today.
Right.
Or they called me, or they did whatever in violation of that restraining order, letting law enforcement know so they can document it. Sure. And so there again, the law enforcement agencies work very closely with us. They don't work for us, though. So.
Sure. But, I mean, you know, from a law enforcement aspect, it is pretty hard for them to cover everything that happens, isn't it?
Absolutely. They have limited manpower, just like my office does. You know, they can only be certain places. They only have so many guys on a shift at any given time, and, you know, they may have to prioritize their calls as they come in. You know, obviously, if there's a homicide or something or there's a bomb threat at a school, or there's a major event that affects public safety, that's priority number one.
Sure.
And there again, you're right. You know,
it's
sometimes
hard.
You know, that particular victim may make a call and they don't have someone come out immediately. Well, it may be because those guys are somewhere else and take them a little while to get there. And so it is a very tough job that the sheriff has and the police chiefs. They do their best with what they have.
Now, one of the things we also want to talk about was the formation of the Veterans Court, and we haven't touched on that, but this is a pretty big deal that's been started here in Greenwood.
It is. The only two other solicitors in the state that had a Veterans Court before we started ours were the Fifth Circuit, which covers Richland and Kershaw, big circuit, covers Columbia, 13th Circuit, which covers Greenville-Pickens, another one of the large circuits in our state. They have a tremendous amount of resources in both of those circuits that I don't have. In Greenville, they have 45 prosecutors. We have 15, including me. And so that just tells you they have three times the number of prosecutors we do because they have a significant amount of resources. Kerry Bolt came to me. He's our veterans officer here for Greenwood and for Lawrence, mm-hmm. for both counties. And Kerry had heard about the Veterans Court programs that were already in place and asked me, is this something that we could do here? We have seen a number of guys come through our court system that were veterans, that served our country honorably, that for whatever reason, after they were discharged, many times fell into an alcohol abuse situation or a prescription drug abuse or other things, and end up somehow intersecting, getting charges and coming onto our docket. My thought is these guys are in a little bit different category being charged just because of the service they've given. And a lot of times their substance abuse issues are tied directly to what they saw in combat and the things that they, the stress that they endured. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of them have substance abuse issues that tie directly to that. Some of them were injured, ended up having to take pain medication because of combat injuries, and then they end up getting addicted to those drugs. And, mm-hmm. you know, as we know about addiction, that becomes a problem. So we have some folks that have come through the criminal justice system that need the services of Veterans Court. What we can do in Veterans Court with the help of Veterans Affairs guys like Kerry Bolt is we can keep them accountable, make sure that they're going to their drug abuse counseling and all the things that the Veterans Administration, the VRA already provides this mm-hmm. for these guys, and most of them qualify. They just need that accountability to make sure that they're getting clean and they're becoming productive again and they're getting through their issues. And so there's some crimes that won't qualify for Veterans Court. Obviously, violent crimes, you know, are in a little bit different category. But those that are saddled with substance abuse and maybe small theft issues to steal in to support their habit and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, this is something that sometimes will be an option.
Is this similar to the drug court?
Very similar. It's similar in the way it operates, in the sense that most of these guys' requirements through Veterans Court will be related to them getting help for their substance abuse problems. It's just that what makes Veterans Court a little bit better for us and the participants is it's a little bit less expensive on the front end, because what we do through drug court is we hire service providers under contract that we pay partially through the fees that are paid by the participants and partially through money that we get from the state that helps to subsidize it. Mm-hmm. Veterans Court's a little bit different because the services are already being provided. There is a structure for it that we don't have to pay extra for. And so the fees for the Veterans Court participants are actually a little bit less than drug court. But it operates the same way. They go and see the judge once a month. They have accountability there. If they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, they can be kicked out of the program and go back to being prosecuted.
Sure.
But they also get that encouragement from the judge if they're doing what they're supposed to do to kind of give that attaboy speech. Judge Addy, Frank Addy's been very involved with our Greenwood Drug Court. Judge Griffith in Newberry, Judge Hocker in Lawrence have come on board and been very involved with our Newberry and Lawrence participants. They actually hold drug court in Lawrence now, whereas before everyone in the circuit had to come to Greenwood. So we've expanded the program, the drug court program. Veterans Court is just going to be another layer of that.
Now, where are the offices going to be for that?
Well, right now we're running it out of our office at Park Plaza. Brian Campbell is my drug court coordinator. He also is going to run Veterans Court. And so we've given him that additional responsibility, which he gladly took on. He was a big believer in this program, too. We sat down with Kerry Bolt, and Brian's a great guy. He got real fired up about it when we started talking about this and helping our veterans. Potentially, we've been in discussions with Kerry and the Veterans Administration. They may have some office space for us there. We haven't worked out the details on that. So we'll see how that ends up. I don't think a decision's been made by Kerry and the county guys that have jurisdiction over those offices. Certainly, if Brian had some working space over there, we may actually be able to partner with Veterans
Sure.
Administration Building, which is a very nice facility. Yeah, I would encourage any of your listeners who haven't been over there yet to go check it out. It's really a really neat building. They've done
it's hard
a lot
to believe
it.
It's the old library, isn't it?
It is. They did a lot of work on the inside of that place. And a lot of the veterans organizations, the auxiliaries and the others have really done a great job and worked hard in those buildings and done a good job with it. So that may work out. If it doesn't, certainly we will continue to work out of Park Plaza. Brian has an office there now where Veterans Court participants would come in to our office just like drug court participants do. And generally these guys are not your hardened criminals. Even the drug court participants are ones that we don't even put them in the program if we don't feel like that they have a desire to get out of this lifestyle.
Sure.
And so hopefully they're people that are becoming very quickly law-abiding citizens again, whether it's Veterans Court or Drug Court. So we're real excited about the Veterans Court program.
That's right. And you are listening right here to WCRS. Real quick, we've Had a good time here talking to David. David here today. Wanted to talk about your volunteers for your community juvenile arbitration program. That's a program that I have known about, have had some of the people on that had been involved in it in the past, and I see where you're looking for volunteers for this program now.
We are. We're coming up on our yearly training to train more volunteer arbitrators, and this is a great program. If you are looking for an area to plug in this community and make a difference in a life, I would encourage you to contact my office. Julie Bledsoe in my office does a great job at doing the training. It's not a huge time commitment, but it is a little bit of a time commitment. I think the training sessions are once a week for
Tuesdays and Thursdays, from April 7th to the April 28th, 5:30 to 8:30.
That's right. I think we compressed it a little bit. Last year we spread it out over a couple of months and once a week. I think this year we're trying to just make it 3 weeks, get it done on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So, but I really would encourage anyone in the community that wants to give back their time. That's all it's going to cost you. It's not going to cost you any money. You won't get paid. You won't get rich doing it. But what we will literally have you do is be involved with the offender, their family, the victims and family. If it's, say, a case where a kid breaks into someone's shed and steals something and they're caught, the juvenile arbitration program not only requires the offender to restore and make restitution, there's other requirements, and the victims actually can have input on that. And as an arbitrator, you're kind of helping make sure that that kid that we see in that program doesn't end up being an adult offender. And we've seen a lot of success with that program. And I'd encourage anyone who's interested to contact our office.
That's right. And Julie's number is 942-8843. That's 942-8843. Now, real quick, before we get off the air, because I'm sure we'll get some calls on it, how does somebody who maybe is a juvenile offender get into the arbitration program? And how would somebody that was a veteran get into veterans court?
They would just have to ask the prosecutor in my office that's handling the case. So that's all it takes, is a referral from our prosecutors. It may be a case I'm handling. It may be one of my assistant solicitors. Specifically for juvenile arbitration, Adam Bacot is on contract with my office. He's a lawyer here in town. Adam does a great job doing juvenile prosecutions for us. And so Adam has come to me with some of these cases and said, this is kind of a close call, and we've talked about whether it's appropriate for arbitration. But most of the time, he's making that decision in his discretion as the prosecutor in my office. Veterans Court's the same thing. If someone has a charge, if it's a DUI, it might be a possession of a controlled substance, anything like that. We're talking about charges that don't involve major violence. Those are not ones we're going to put into Veterans Court, I'm sorry. But they need to ask, either if they're represented by an attorney, have your attorney ask my assistant solicitor if Veterans Court would be appropriate. And if our prosecutor or assistant solicitor is handling the case, refers it, it goes into the program.
Okay. So if somebody is in that situation, that's how you would get into that program, just by asking.
Correct.
If that is possible.
Correct. And it would take the approval of the assistant solicitor. I typically don't micromanage those decisions. I trust the people we have. We have a lot of good level-headed prosecutors that aren't they're tough in court, and they're going to try a lot of these cases, but there's some of these cases where they know that this person is appropriate for a second chance.
Sure.
And so that's all it would take. Usually if someone has a lawyer that already is representing them, for them to talk to their lawyer and say, hey, can I get into this Veterans Court program, and have the lawyer contact our assistant solicitor and ask for a referral.
Okay. And then as far as the juveniles, the same type of thing?
That's correct. Yeah, that would be through Adam specifically, since he handles all the juvenile cases, to have – if they're not represented by counsel, they can ask us directly, because we can't talk to someone who has an attorney ethically. So, but if they have an attorney, to go through the attorney and ask.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you one question real quick here. Just we're already supposed to be done, but Mike Pitts is introducing a bill that would decriminalize marijuana in South Carolina for small amounts.
Right.
Where do you stand on that, David?
I think it's something that's coming, and Either way, I mean, it's been legalized in other states. It's probably going to be legalized. Marijuana will be legal here at some point in the future. I don't know when. Obviously, while the laws are still in place, my job is not to make the laws, but to prosecute them. And so we will prosecute the laws that are on the books as long as they're there. Representative Pitts is a very good representative. He works very well with me.
He was a police officer.
He was a police officer, and there I can. There again, I have a lot of friends that are I would consider libertarian, and I probably trend a little bit towards that direction too. I think we have probably too many laws on the books in this country. We probably need less laws and more enforcement of the ones that really matter. And I
more
think
common
that's
common sense, maybe.
Yes, correct. And so there's many who would argue that alcohol is much more destructive than marijuana. And so there are those arguments out there, I think, that have some merit. There again. If it passes, I don't think I'll lose any sleep over it. I know the chief of SLED has been very vocal in his opposition to it. Chief Keel and I have had those discussions. The solicitors around the state, I think, are probably where I am. I'm not really strong in either camp other than to say we will prosecute the crimes that are on the books because that's what we've been sworn to do. And so. But if those laws change, then we'll move on to what we're doing. I'll say this. The focus of our narcotics units on a local level have not really been with marijuana. They've been much more heavily focused on methamphetamine, crack cocaine. We're seeing some more heroin here now, which is a very addictive, destructive street-level drug. And prescription drug abuse is rampant, which seems to be a lot more destructive right now than marijuana. That's not to say that law enforcement's not still making marijuana arrests. They are. But it's not necessarily the focus of their proactive work. And so I think in some ways there's been a de-emphasis in the criminal justice world on marijuana already. Mm-hmm. And there again, Representative Pitts, I think that's a fairly bipartisan bill because Representative Pitts will be considered more right-wing libertarian. I think the co-sponsor might be Todd Rutherford, who I can't remember who the co-sponsor is, but I think it's someone who's, you know, maybe on the more left-wing Democrat side. So it's certainly a bipartisan bill that's being put forward. I'm not sure whether it'll pass or not this year, but I think eventually, if it doesn't pass this year, something like this is going to pass at some point in the next few years.
Well, you always have the state looking for ways to make money.
Well, I guess so. Yeah, that seizures and all the forfeiture world, we handle some of that in my office. But
yeah, no, I was talking about marijuana being totally
taxed and all that.
And all that thing.
You know, I really haven't. I probably need to do a little more research on what has happened in Colorado. I know some of the ones that are more involved with this bill have done a little more research on that. I'm not sure how that's playing out for Colorado right now. I'm sure they're making a lot of tax revenue money off of it, but
I think one of the biggest problems is because of the federal laws that they can't technically have bank accounts and they can't take charge cards and it's an all cash business. Just think about it, David.
It is, and it's hard to track a all cash business. So I don't know. We'll see how it plays out here. I think it's something that nationwide, this has been building over probably the last 15, 20 years, and it's getting stronger. And I think most citizens are more concerned about some of the harder drugs that are a safety hazard and a public health hazard. I mean, methamphetamine, if it's cooked up in a hotel room, you may be staying in the hotel room that two nights ago they were cooking meth. And you'd never know it if they weren't caught doing it. And so that's a major public health issue.
Absolutely.
To be exposed to those chemicals.
Well, thank you for coming out this afternoon. I think we've had an interesting and varied conversation here today, David.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Ann. And as always, love to come back on the show anytime.
All right. That's going to do it for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.